From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
When cold weather approaches, we humans usually have it easy. We can retreat to the shelter of central heating or pile on more layers of clothing. The path to survival is a lot more complicated for birds, of course, and a new book delves into how they have adapted to face the challenges of cold and scarcity of food that winter represents. The book is The Courage of Birds and the Often Surprising Ways They Survive Winter, and one of its co-creators, David Sibley, is here to talk about some of the impressive suite of tactics that different species have developed to live to see another spring. More in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, WhiteFlowerFarm.com.
The book, The Courage of Birds, is just out, written by Pete Dunn, author of more than 20 books about birds, and illustrated by today's guest, David Sibley, one of whose indispensable Sibley guides I suspect may be on your bookshelf or even beside your binoculars. Their new book looks at strategies North American birds have evolved to meet winter head on, and I'm so glad David could make time to be here today to tell us about some of those as winter heads our way, too. Hi, David. It's good to talk to you again.
Hi, Margaret. Thanks. It's great to be on.
Yes, and what I think we'll do is we'll, with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com, I'll have a giveaway of the new book, The Courage of Birds. And I guess we haven't spoken since about 2020 when your wonderful book, What It's Like to Be a Bird, was published. And actually, I just gave a copy of that to a new birder, a young friend the other day. So it's a wonderful book that explains what they're all doing out there. And that's, I guess, what this book does too.
Yeah, great. Yeah. Thank you. Yes. Yeah. A lot of the things that Pete wrote about in this book, I had written about in What It's Like to Be a Bird.
So. Exactly. And so this isn't your first collaboration with Pete. Between the two of you, I think at least one entire shelf in my bookcase is stuffed full of books. You two are both so prolific. And yeah, I think it was like 2012, maybe, the revised edition of Hawks in Flight. I think maybe you collaborated on that as well. Is that a memory?
Yeah. Well, I first met Pete at Cape May my first year. Well, when I arrived there, he hired me to help with the Hawk Watch in 1980. When all that was just getting started.
Yeah. And,
pretty quickly, we developed a collaboration, and I got involved with working on Hawks in Flight that Pete and Clay Sutton were working on.
Right.
The original, the first edition didn't come out until 1988. And then around that time also, I illustrated Pete's book, his collection of essays, Tales of a Low-Rent Birder, and there were a couple of other projects in there as well.
Yeah, well, I have most of those and more. So as he writes in the new book, The Courage of Birds, it's not just penguins in Antarctica who had to figure out how to be tough in the face of cold. Birds in many regions have to sort of have a line of defense against winter. And feathers, I guess, are the first line of defense. So I thought maybe we could start by talking a little bit about feathers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what they do.
Yeah. Well, yeah, feathers are, I will say feathers are what we see of a bird. When you look at a bird out there in the wild, basically all you see is feathers. They're streamlining, waterproofing, windproofing, insulation, coloration, all those things, and just incredibly evolved and perfectly adapted to that. And the down feathers that birds have, the fluffy, soft feathers that really provide a lot of the insulation, are still the most effective insulation known. Nothing synthetic surpasses them. The
Right.
down feathers by weight are the most efficient insulation that's known. And that's what birds
Right,
have.
and of course, mankind keeps trying to mimic it, and makes synthetic versions of down substitutes, so to speak, for our pillows or our blankets or whatever, our coats, our winter coats. Honoring that effective, that stroke of genius of down. And speaking of feathers, a couple of the tactics, the strategies that birds use, if they didn't have feathers, they couldn't do things, tactics against winter's cold, like head tucking and fluffing up the feathers to be even warmer, I guess. So the feathers in winter do a lot of jobs as well.
That birds they can move the feathers. They have there's tiny muscles where the feather attaches in the skin. They can actually raise and lower the feathers on the body. So just by raising all of the feathers up so they stand up a little taller, increases the thickness of their insulating layer. It's like putting on an extra jacket or getting into a sleeping bag, and they fluff up in a basically, they look like a round, fuzzy ball, fluffy ball when they're sleeping. They're fluffed up into a sphere, and they tuck their head in into the feathers of their back so that their bill, a bird's bill, is not insulated. It's exposed, and there is some blood flow in there, and they're breathing, of course, also. So by turning their head around and sticking their bill into the feathers of their back, then their bill is insulated, and their breath cycles through the insulation of their feathers, and they don't lose that heat either.
Right, very efficient. So besides head tucking and fluffing that you were just kind of talking about, in the book, Pete mentions, other strategies like sunning, anti-cold strategies like sunning and cuddling and shivering and flocking and burrowing and torpor. I didn't know that any birds were able to use like torpor, the state of torpor for as an anti-cold device. Chickadees and titmice, maybe, is that, do I remember that right?
And hummingbirds, and not so much in the, I mean, hummingbirds don't stay around in the winter, but they do it just in any colder conditions. But there's one species that actually hibernates called poor will that goes into an extended state of torpor, and their body temperature drops way down, and breathing slows, heart rate slows. But birds like chickadees can do that just overnight, and their body temperature drops to 50 degrees or so, and then when they need to wake up in the morning, they shiver. Their muscles vibrate, twitch to generate heat, and just the metabolism generates heat and warms them up, and they get going again.
And a couple of other strategies are roosting and feeding, and of course, and a stay warm strategy. And when one is going to go to roost, one does so with a full crop, yes, with a stash of food, yes.
And I was surprised to learn that, well, birds birds can sense an approaching storm. They sense presumably the dropping air pressure, and they read signs, instinctively read the signs in the sky, so they know that a storm is coming, like a snowstorm. And anyone who's listening and who lives in a place that has real winter probably notices this, that your bird feeder becomes much more active in the 12 hours before a snowstorm starts, right up to the moment the snowfall begins. And that's the bird's primary response to an approaching storm in the winter, is just to eat more. They fuel up, and then they can go kind of go find a nice sheltered spot out of the wind, and out of the precipitation and hunker down and maybe stay a day or two if they have to, but just living off of the extra food that they took in.
Yeah. So migration, and I'm so old that this topic always makes me think of that song by The Clash. I think it was in the early 1980s, Should I Stay or Should I Go? And that's the question, right? Like
Yeah.
for birds, for a species of birds, and even individuals within some species that are partial migrants, should I stay or should I go? What are the benefits of either decision? And
Yeah.
yeah, so that's another tactic for
Yeah.
survival. Yeah.
And that's, I mean, one of the things that I liked about Pete's approach to this book is that he considers migration and going to the tropics part of a bird's strategy for surviving winter, which obviously it is, but
Yeah.
some birds in winter go to the tropics.
Yeah.
And that birds that live on insects, like swallows and flycatchers and most of the warblers, they have to go south. And they have to go south before the first frost. So their migration is timed, the evolutionary calendar that they have developed is to migrate south before there's any real threat of a frost and a lack of insects. So they'll be moving south in August from the far north and getting south. They don't want to be caught by a strong cold front and a cold snap, and suddenly all the insects are gone, and they have to then they still have to fuel up to fly 2,000 miles. So they have evolved a system to get a calendar that gets them out of the north before there's any decline of insects. And then other species like sparrows that eat seeds, or robins that eat fruit, they'll stay later and move south in October. So every species has its own strategy, and depending on what it eats and where it's going, what direction it's headed, there's different migration strategies for every species.
Right, I think in the book, he says that 70% of species that are North American breeding birds that breed in Canada or the US, including Alaska, I think migrate at least short distances. And it's interesting because you just mentioned robins. Everyone thinks robins are this, sign of spring. Oh, the robins are back, quote unquote, but the robins are here. I mean, there are robins in Newfoundland, and he says in the book, and southern Alaska in winter, yes.
And that's, when I was growing up in Connecticut in the 1970s, robins were actually really rare in the winter then. And it's kind of a new phenomenon in the last few decades that robins are staying farther north. And I think a lot of it has to do with the plantings and invasive plants that produce a lot of berries. So plants like euonymus and buckthorn and bittersweet here in the Northeast, there's a lot of fruit out there now and through the winter, so robins can actually survive here. And they're not, robins are what we would call a more of a facultative migrant. That's the technical term for that. They're not truly migratory where they go north and south on a schedule. They move in response to food and weather, and they can move like if they find a lot of fruit somewhere, they'll stick around. And when that fruit is all eaten up, they'll move somewhere else. Or if there's a big snowstorm or an ice storm that makes the food hard to get, they'll move. And they might move east or west or even north, if they feel like there's some chance of finding food there. So they just kind of wander all winter. They drift southward, but then they just move around wherever they can find food.
Well, and speaking of following the food or finding the food. I mean, and again, in the book, Pete talks about eruptions, years where I think he describes it as abandoning food impoverished regions for food rich ones. In some years, when there's no crop in the boreal forests or whatever of a given thing, the birds that are dependent on that crop will move farther south and look for sustenance elsewhere. The so-called winter finches. I mean, I remember maybe 15 years ago having a big group of pine grosbeaks
Oh,
spend the
nice.
winter here with me. And and when I first reported it, and through the Cornell Lab Ornithology System, which I think maybe even then was not even digital at that time. I can't remember whether it was eBird or whether it was manual. We did how we did it at the time. But however I did it, emailed it in or did it in eBird.org. They wrote back and said, no, that's not right. Because it was really odd, It was really early, and they just spent the whole winter here. Yeah, and it was just they just were so beautiful, and they're charismatic, and they're gregarious birds. They're not scaredy cats,
Yeah.
it was fun. It was fun to be with them.
Yeah. Yeah, and those eruptions, and it's not like a volcanic eruption, it's a different spelling.
With the letter I, not E.
And that there's two factors in that. One is if there's a very good breeding season and a large number of young birds are produced, then there isn't enough space and enough food in the north to support all of them, and some have to move south. But also, if it's combined with a good breeding season and a lot of young produced, and then a lack of food to support them through the winter, then big numbers will move south. And well, actually, a lot of those species, they'll move east and west as well, like the robins. And very few birds have a truly north-south migration. We say birds go south for the winter, but most of them are migrating southeast or southwest or a lot of different directions.
I've mentioned this on the show before, but I'll tell you this because it was so unusual. And last winter, in December, a Wilson's warbler male showed up at my feeders. And now I'm in, just across the border. You're in Massachusetts, and I think central Massachusetts, and I'm just across the border from the Berkshires in Columbia County, New York, and cold. And he I have water. And I think that's an important thing to say is that they also there's not just food, water is critical all 12 months of the year. And I have unfrozen water, a substantial amount of unfrozen water. And so this bird, who probably got thrown off course in, stormy times during migration or who knows what, he came. And I don't know how in the world this little creature even adapted to eating seeds and feeding at the feet. He didn't go on the perches of the feeders, but he ate beneath the feeders and kind of integrated into the group. And it was this strangest thing. And it went on for weeks and weeks. And I don't know what became of him, I mean, obviously. But yeah, it was yeah. But so there's these things that we feel privileged as humans to see, but it's also kind of upsetting, kind of terrifying, like the idea of a creature being thrown so far off course that they're outside where they're safe, where they would have chosen to go,
If you put yourself in their shoes, so to speak, it's a scary prospect. But it's also, I mean, from an evolutionary sense, those are the pioneers, and they're if that bird survives, if it ends up, it's gone off course, but if it ends up in a place that works for it, where it survives the winter and comes back, makes its way back to its breeding grounds in a healthy condition, it could pass on that knowledge of that genetically, that migration pattern, and develop a new wintering area for the species is that kind of diversity of strategies is really good for the long-term survival of the species.
Yeah.
These are the pioneers, and
Well, and sort of speaking of that in a longer term sense, in the book, Pete Dunne writes about how, having to do with the relationship with seeds, like 370 million years ago, plants began encasing their seeds in protective shells, and then 250 million years later, birds began to use those seeds for winter food, and that was a big change, allowed this adaptation to seed eating allowed birds to remain in northern areas when there were no insects, some species to do so. Yeah. So the coevolution between plants and of course, then the birds moved the seeds around, so they helped the plants in this relationship that developed.
There's a lot of coevolution of birds and fruit. The fruit attracts the birds eat it, and they carry the seeds and deposit them all across the globe.
And I love some species cache the seeds, right? They sort of make little stashes of it. Yes.
And some species, I mean, they start early in the summer, storing food that they will use in the winter. The Canada jay, which is one that I know Pete writes about in the book, and I did an illustration of, that's one of the real champions of food caching. They live in the North Woods in Canada mostly, as the name implies. And they start in the early summer, hiding food, just finding insects, seeds, fruit, anything edible, and stashing it. And they can, some studies on other species like Clark's nutcracker and chickadees are two other species that cache food. They can remember tens of thousands of hiding places. They have, I guess, a little map in their head of all the places that they've put little bits of food, and they can go back and find them all.
It's astonishing. I mean, that's the part that you just never get over, the awe, the sense of awe of nature, do you?
There's so much going on that we don't appreciate until we begin to kind of figure out what's going on, but there's so much more that we don't even know about.
I wanted to take a few minutes to just talk about another form of another a source of seeds, and that is that, and it's written about in the book as well, we've become a nation of bird feeders. We feed birds in large numbers. And how has that impacted birds in winter? How has that changed things?
The studies that have been done on bird feeding show no real effects. Some slight increase in survival of birds getting through real bottlenecks like ice storms. But birds don't become reliant on the feeders even after. One study, a feeder that had been operating continuously for several decades was taken down, and the birds that had been using it were watched to see how they fared without the feeders after generations of birds had used these feeders, and there was no real effect. Birds, even though you'll see birds continuously visiting your feeders, but they're still getting at least half of their food in the wild, in nature, and they, if you stop feeding, if you leave your feeder empty for a week while you go on vacation, those birds, they'll go back to natural food sources with no problem. It probably has helped some of the species like red-bellied woodpecker and Carolina wren that have expanded their range north in the last few decades, tufted titmouse.
I'm laughing about Carolina wren because I have some very bossy ones here that I, of course, years ago they weren't here. I didn't see them, and now I have them year round, and they're quite a lot of personality.
And those species, they're at the northern limit of their range here in New England and upstate New York, and the bird feeders probably helped them colonize this area and help them survive. But it's probably not really having a huge impact on bird populations. It's just a nice bonus for the birds that use it.
And hopefully it brings more people into contact with nature in a way that makes them more aware of these relationships and, well, hopefully care more about animal species and so forth. That's
Yeah.
yeah, that would be my hope. Yeah.
I think that's my best
Yeah.
the
Yeah.
my best point about bird feeding. The thing
Yeah.
I
Just
tell people is that it's just a great way for us to interact with the birds.
yeah, make a connection.
Yeah.
So in the last minute or two, I just wanted to ask, speaking of, bird feeding and having bird feeders in the yard, it's that time of year, people are putting them out and so forth. And safety, one of the things that I saw on your Facebook page this fall, I know at least once, and you've reminded people about it a number of times over the years I've been, watching, reading your stuff about window strikes and how they kill, what, 1 billion birds a year, I think.
Yeah.
So any tips on that, just in the last minute or two, on what we should be not doing or doing to minimize that danger?
Yeah, it's a challenge because it's so dispersed. Each window might only have one or two bird strikes a year, but when you multiply that by the
Right.
number of windows, it's a huge number. The most effective and the best way to prevent it is to put some markings or like tape on the outside of the window in vertical strips no more than 3 inches apart, I think is the recommendation. So it creates a barrier that the birds can see and that they see it and they think they probably can't fly through it. You have to make birds are seeing the reflection of the world around them in the
Right.
window and thinking that it's a space they can fly into, and then they crash into the glass. So putting vertical lines across that makes it clear to the birds that there's some kind of barrier there, and they probably can't fly through it, and that will reduce. Nearly eliminate window strikes. And the American Bird Conservancy has a lot of information about this, and
Okay.
they sell
I'll
the
give a
tape and
link.
some other solutions.
I'll give a link to that. And I noticed on your Facebook page you had something from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service from a department within there that had some good tips too. So I'll share both those links.
Yeah.
I'm so glad to speak to you again, and congratulations on the new book. Please share my good wishes with Pete Dunn and my appreciation. And I hope I'll talk to you again soon. Thanks.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening and bird watching meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.